Well, welcome to the seventh episode of Primary Care Update. I'm Dr. Mark A. Bell. I'm a family physician and professor at UGA and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus, an evidence-based online primary care reference. Please check it out at essentialevidenceplus.com. Primary Care Update is our summary of recent research that we think is relevant to primary care medicine. The opinions expressed are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any products. If you're a primary care doc, please read the article yourself to form your own conclusions. If you're a patient, please talk to your primary care physician. As usual, I am joined today by my friends John Hickner, a family physician and editor of the Journal of Family Practice, and Henry Berry, professor of family medicine at Michigan State University. Hey guys, how you doing today?
Doing well.
Doing fine here. I do feel obligated to update our readers on the weather in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. We've had about 6 inches of snow so far, and my snowblower works terrific.
We have not had any snow yet here in Georgia. But we did have an awful football game against Alabama, and Michigan lost against Ohio State, so it was just a rough weekend overall last week.
We'll pull out the violins.
But the good news is that Urban Meyer resigned, and so now Jim Harbaugh won't be out coached next year.
There you go. All right, turning from football. I also wanted to plug a podcast. Steve Brown and his colleagues at the University of Arizona Family Medicine Residency. Many of you probably already listened to it, but check out the AFP podcast, where they summarize each issue of the journal in a very entertaining way. So the first poem today is Increased Water Intake Decreases UTI Recurrence in Women. Kind of tells you the whole story there. This was a study in JAMA Internal Medicine. Hooten was the first author, volume 178, page 1509, if you're following along at home. They took 140 premenopausal women who had three or more documented episodes of lower UTI, but no pylo in the previous year. They were randomized to continue their normal levels of water intake or to drink an additional 1.5 liters of, get this, Evian-branded water daily for 12 months. Not sure if other kinds of water work as well, but I suspect they do.
Was it with bubbles or without?
I think the bubbly kind. Yeah, the bubbly kind. Maybe that makes a difference. Who knows? Adherence to this water regimen was good. Women in the extra water group ended up having about half as many UTIs as the usual intake group, about 1.7 versus 3.2 infections in the coming 12 months. So that's pretty good. It's cutting them in half. It's, you know, more than one fewer UTI just by drinking 1.5 extra liters of water. It did have a downside in that it resulted in an average of 2 more trips to the bathroom per day than the usual intake group. So drinking an additional 1.5 liters per day of water halved the recurrences of UTI in women with a history of at least 3 episodes. I think there's something we've always thought worked, but they were smart enough to go out and actually prove it. Guys, what do you think?
So this reminded me a little bit of our very first collaborative project. Listeners know that Mark, John, and I did a master's program together, but we did a cost-utility analysis on the management of urinary tract infections, and Hooten was actually one of the information sources. This is an author who has been publishing on urinary tract infections for many years. While our focus was on acute treatment, this also gave me a chance to look at, well, what's in the Cochrane database for other things that we can do to reduce the recurrence of urinary tract infections? And so there were 3 items that came up as that they addressed. One was cranberry juice, which seems to be effective. Post-coital voiding, turns out that didn't really reduce the frequency of UTIs, but post-coital antibiotics also did reduce them.
I do wonder if the positive result from cranberry juice, which frankly is not all that strong, is simply due to the water in the cranberry juice and has very little to do with the cranberry juice.
Some have actually looked at, there's an ingredient in cranberry juice that when incorporated into animal models reduces bacterial adherence to the bladder mucosa. So there may be something more than just the fluid intake itself. It's certainly not due to any changes in pH.
Yeah, you and your basic science. I've tried to forget all that stuff.
Well, water is cheaper.
Successfully, yeah, I might add.
Water is cheaper.
Yeah, but you know, there may be something to the, you know, I don't know that the fizziness has anything, but it would be interesting to compare water with the same amount of cranberry with the same amount of another juice. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's Hooten's next study. Yep. We also did a project together. We looked at we did a randomized trial of telephone versus in-clinic management for UTI in adult healthy women, and found that they did just as well managing it over the phone. So I think we've answered all the questions about UTI. Henry, I think it's time for your quiz today.
Yes, this is about Theophylline. So Theophylline, one, is an ancient Greek god who appeared in the Iliad and the Odyssey. Two, has a wide toxic therapeutic window. Three, has very few problematic interactions with food and other drugs. Four, is very well tolerated. Five, when added in low dose to inhaled corticosteroids, prevents COPD exacerbations. Stay tuned.
John, I think it's time for your poem, and I think it's titled Limited Data, Deprescribing is Safe, but at a Risk of Symptom Recurrence.
Yes, the title of the study itself, which is a systematic review, is called The Effects of Discontinuation of Chronic Medication in Primary Care. It's a systematic review of deprescribing trials published in the British Journal of General Practice, 2018, volume 68. The chief author is Theo. The authors found 27 randomized trials of various sizes, ranging from a small of 20 to a large of 2,471 patients. In 16 of these studies, they compared deprescribing to placebo deprescribing, and in 11 others, it was compared to usual care. They couldn't pool the data together in a meta-analysis because there was so much variability in the drugs, the target groups, follow-up duration. So they had to give an overall systematic review. 10 of the studies were of low risk of bias. That's too bad. It would be nice if they all were. But at any rate, I think the results are quite interesting, and they're variable. The rate of successful deprescribing, defined as stopping the medication and not restarting it, or the patient not suffering from that, varied greatly from 20% of the drugs to 100%. In 19 of the 27 studies, the deprescribing rate exceeded 50%. That's a lot of discontinued drugs. 16 of the studies reported on symptom relapse or resumption, and that ranged a great deal too. In some studies, there was no adverse effects of deprescribing, and others up to 80%. So these studies obviously are very different. Among the 9 placebo-controlled studies that reported on relapse, 5 found significantly greater relapse in the intervention group. Again, the rates varied from 14% to 50%. So at any rate, I would say the bottom line is that stopping long-term medications can be done successfully, probably in up to 50% of cases where the doctor feels that that's indicated and the patient agrees to do it. I mean, you don't deprescribe for no reason, in other words. And this is something that I've been practicing myself, I would say, for over 20 years. I was inspired by a geriatrician at Michigan State who, when he took over a nursing home, had over 200 patients. And over the course of a year and a half, he cut down the average number of medications per patient from roughly 9 to roughly 4.5. So there's the 50% right there, with very little adverse effect or need to restart medication. So I think that part of our job as family physicians is protecting our patients, not only from too many interventions, but also from too much medication. So we need to be careful to review that medication list. And when we're in doubt that a patient needs it, it's time to negotiate with the patient about gradual withdrawal or discontinuing. What do you think?
Yeah, this process is one that really requires some negotiation. It requires us to maybe identify those medications that are truly essential from those that are lifestyle, comfort, things of that nature. Negotiate with the patient which ones to work on. But it also means that we have to kind of monitor and follow up to make sure that all of our goals of deprescribing are being met.
Yeah, there's another issue of kind of, what do you call it, re-prescribing maybe. So I find lots of patients who are still taking Atenolol, for example, for blood pressure, and they're not on an ACE or an ARB or a calcium channel blocker or a diuretic. And so it takes a little time to have a conversation. We've learned a lot about blood pressure, blah, 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 and, you know, switch them to something more effective. But yeah, I think we all take pride in trying to minimize the number of medications, especially our older and more vulnerable patients are on. And, you know, there's a cost issue. You know, these meds aren't free to our patients or to our health system. And I think it's a great reminder that we always need to keep this on our radar when we see those long med lists. And I think the last comment would be that when you have increasingly patients being managed by hospitalists, when they're in the hospital, they come home often on some medications that they may not need to really stay on. Do they really still need that proton pump inhibitor that they had while they were in the hospital, for example? So I think, it's always good to, and if you're on a proton pump inhibitor, can they be on a lower dose or can they be on an H2 blocker instead, just as effectively? So even if you're not stopping a medication, you know, you're trying to move to maybe a safer category.
The other similar issue is when a patient develops, could be a minor symptom, a look at their medication list and see if the med might be causing the problem. I had one patient with a chronic cough, and she was taking just a small dose of Elavil for sleep. And when we stopped that, her cough went away and she was able to discontinue other medications. So think medication with symptoms.
Great advice. Thanks, John. Henry, I think you have the next poem.
Yes. So this next poem asks, what is the incidence of sudden cardiac death in athletes and what causes it? This is by Malhotra in the New England Journal of Medicine, volume 379, issue number 6, pages 524 to 534. Malhotra has actually done quite a few studies in this arena. And just as an aside, by the way, since we were having our little chit-chat, this coming weekend is the NCAA men's soccer Final Four, and Akron, Michigan State University, Indiana University, and the University of Maryland are all in there. So we've got three Big Ten teams, all of whom have a certain affiliation with your speakers here. So we have a vested interest in this.
Yeah, you're in a tough spot, Henry. Who are you going to root for?
My loyalties can't be bought. So
that means Maryland, right?
That's right. alma mater is always first. So in this particular study, the researchers evaluated promising football players aged 15 to 17 who were enrolled in the English Football Association. That's soccer to Americans, football to the rest of the world. Okay, just pointing that out. All of them underwent a structured cardiovascular assessment to screen for disorders associated with cardiac death, a history and physical EKG echocardiogram. This is a 20-year study with over 11,000 young athletes who were screened. Far and away, most of them were men or young adolescent males. Of that 11,000, about 800 needed additional evaluation. Ultimately, 42 of these had a disorder associated with cardiac death, well under 0.5%. The most common was Wolff Parkinson-White, and then hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. The rest had some valvular anomalies. The athletes were told, listen, you've got this disorder that's associated with cardiac death. You probably ought to have it fixed, medically managed before you return to play. And if that wasn't possible, they said, you know, you probably should not participate in athletics. Some of us have had this conversation. So they had roughly 10 years of follow-up on average for each of these athletes. And over that 118,000 person years of follow-up, there were only 8 sudden cardiac deaths, 2 in the athletes who had a cardiomyopathy who decided to play anyway. One had an arrhythmia. And the other 5 actually had a cardiomyopathy, but it wasn't detected at the time of their screening. So the cost of this was about $350 per athlete in the UK. Now, the cost of an echocardiogram in the UK was only about $100, which is significantly lower than it is here in the US. So I think the upshot to this is that, A, these conditions are fairly rare. And even among the athletes who have these conditions, sudden cardiac death is also fairly rare. Now, I've had an interest in this for many years. When I was an undergrad at the University of Maryland, we had 2 of our basketball players, Chris Patton and Owen Brown, die on the basketball court. One had Wolff Parkinson-White, and the other one had Marfan syndrome. I was also on a task force for 2 years for the state of Michigan, where we reviewed every young person who had a sudden unexpected death. And we had a team that included pathologists and cardiologists and pediatricians. And what we found was that most of the time, the reason for the sudden death was because of a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And I say this because in the Italian studies, when they report the sources of sudden cardiac death, you see much more on the cardiac arrhythmia side, prolonged QT intervals, Brugada syndrome. So I think it's really critical for us to realize that this is actually a fairly heterogeneous, probably significant variability of whether it's from country to country or from population to population. And we can invest a lot of money without necessarily a lot of positive outcomes. It also raises a lot of ethical issues about participation and what do people choose to do. So we remember Hank Gathers, who actually chose to stop taking medication, ended up dying playing basketball as well. So this creates all kinds of passions for people because it's young people who are dying.
Well, that's a really interesting report. And I think one thing I took away from that was, that the history, physical, and EKG detected about 90% of the athletes with a significant abnormality. The echo didn't add a whole lot. And given the cost, inconvenience, practicality of echo, I think you can really find most of these folks with history, physical, and EKG. And so the question is, do we add an EKG to the standard, high school physical exam? Is that something you think we should be considering or only for elite athletes? Or what would you say?
We actually ended up working with the Michigan High School Scholastic Athletic Association over this. And the first and most important thing that we did was we changed the sports pre-participation exam form. The old one was little more than a lick and a prayer. This we actually provided guidance around screening questions to identify athletes who might be at higher risk, physical exam findings, but we also provided guidance if you've got a young person with Down syndrome, for example, to assess atlantoaxial instability and other factors that might influence safe participation. We did not recommend doing routine AKGs in large part because of the demographics, seeing much more hypertrophic cardiomyopathy.
Interesting. So thank you for that. Some sports medicine. Henry, I know that's a long time interest of yours, and I know you were the physician, weren't you, for the I think the lacrosse team at Michigan State, and you've worked with some teams up there.
Yeah, lacrosse and track and field, and I was actually had to deal with this a little bit when I was the head physician for the Big Ten track and field championships when the sprinter from Ohio State University collapsed on the track the week before the tournament, having to deal with planning around the event and figuring out what was the source of his loss of consciousness.
Interesting. Yeah, I had the experience of being told that I should quit the sport of basketball, but that was because I sucked at it in high school. Have you heard of volleyball, Mark? And that's, I ended up taking up volleyball. Anyway, so let's see. We have I have another poem. I've decided to do two this month because this was a study that got a lot of press and I think is very interesting and really potentially practice changing. So it's by Gerard, was the first author for the MIND USA Investigators, Haloperidol and Ziprasidone for Treatment of Delirium in Critical Illness, New England Journal of Medicine, October 22nd. So they asked the question, does the use of antipsychotics decrease the duration of delirium in critically ill patients with respiratory failure or shock? So this was a randomized trial and really one of the first adequately powered, sized modern trials to look at this question. So they had critically ill patients with delirium who were using an invasive or non-invasive mechanical ventilation or taking vasopressors or requiring intra-aortic balloon pumps. So sick people and where delirium is not uncommon. The patients were randomized to one of three groups. They either got IV Haldol, 2.5 milligrams, Ziprasidone, which is Geodon, 5 milligrams, or placebo. The doses were given every 12 hours, and they were adjusted based on the patient response. So if there was no apparent response, that was increased. If there was a response or side effects, it was decreased. And the patients were kept on the medications for 14 days or until they were discharged. Anyone developing a complication like torsade de pointe or neuroleptic malignant syndrome or drug reaction had the drug stopped, of course. The 566 patients in the three groups were similar at baseline. Compared to placebo, neither drug, Haldol or Geodon, significantly increased the number of days alive without delirium or coma. It was about 8 days in all three groups. There was no difference in 30-day or 90-day survival, ICU discharge, readmission, or hospital discharge. So no benefit, no fewer days with delirium with either drug. For patients, so I guess the bottom line for patients with acute respiratory failure and shock who developed delirium in the ICU, antipsychotics, either older or the newer, quote, atypical or novel antipsychotics, don't reduce the duration of delirium. The study could have detected at least a 2-day difference in the duration of delirium. So it's possible that there might be a very small benefit of, let's say, one fewer day, but they didn't see that in this study. Henry, what do you think?
So delirium
practice
really,
changer.
Since I don't do much ICU medicine these days and our ICUs are closed, it won't affect me directly, but it is an important topic. You know, delirium has a high fatality rate associated with it. It can occur outside of the ICU, especially among our very ill patients and the elderly with dementia in particular. And I'm reminded that there are non-pharmacologic approaches, paying attention to quality sleep among the elderly, make sure that they have their glasses and their hearing aids, that they have sensory inputs, making sure that they're well hydrated. All of those are simple measures that have been shown in the Cochrane to be effective at reducing delirium. There are also some other simple things such as using soft lighting, subdued sound, soft music, and maybe even having some signage to help to orient them to their circumstances, items from home that to lend a certain familiarity, especially to our elderly who are often feeling like, well, I'm no longer home. Where am I? I'm lost. And they start to get into that tailspin of agitation and excitation that causes the nursing staff to appropriately get very upset.
Yeah. John, any comments about this?
Yeah, I think this is part of a pattern that we see in older people especially, that these types of medications don't really seem to do a lot of good in terms of symptom control. And at least case control studies show that the mortality rate is higher with these drugs in older nursing home patients. So I think a lot of caution in using these types of medications in older folks is needed.
Yeah, I just got a phone call from a very good friend of mine went to college with, and his mother is 89 and is living in assisted living in their town in North Carolina. And she was just hospitalized and was very delirious, and it was very upsetting to my friend. And so that's part of it. It's a very upsetting to the family to see their pretty decent functioning elder all of a sudden babbling incoherently and not making any sense. And we talked about some of those things you just described, Henry, and they were doing none of them in the hospital. And once she got hydrated up, I talked to him again a couple of days later. Once she got hydrated up and was there, she was doing much better. But I think I asked him, what's her current medication list? And we talked about that. And she was getting Klonopin as an outpatient, which I thought not a great idea for an 89-year-old to be taking Klonopin. And then they put her on Haldol. And so it makes me wonder how long this is going to take to actually change practice, because it's so routine now. You know, the nurse calls, can we prescribe some Haldol, just a low dose, blah, blah, blah. And it's so common. And how I think it's going to require education of not only physicians who are working in the ICU, but also the nurses and other staffs to make them understand that while it's easy, it's actually not very effective, if at all. Okay. Very interesting and good extra information, Henry and John. Appreciate that. So I think we're going to wrap it up now. This is the quiz answer from Henry.
All right. So this is about theophylline. Theophylline, turns out it's a member of the theobromine family. Theobromine literally is Greek for nectar of the gods. We don't use it a whole lot anymore because it's frankly very difficult to use. Its effectiveness correlates with drug levels, and those drug levels fluctuate wildly based on what other medications a person is taking, as well as nutrient interactions. Patients hate it. It tastes like the bottom of a bird cage. It's bitter. It makes them jumpy and jittery. It makes them sick to their stomach. And in our patients with severe COPD, it really contributes to weight loss and probably in some ways hastens their demise. It's really just a horrible drug that's only slightly better than smothering our patients, that the sensations that they experience with their COPD. It's been largely replaced nearly into oblivion by inhaled long-acting beta agonists, anticholinergics, and inhaled corticosteroids. There was a recent randomized trial by Devereaux published in JAMA that really found minimal benefit of adding low-dose theophylline to inhaled corticosteroids. These were patients with moderate to severe COPD who had frequent exacerbations. It turns out that it really did not do anything for the average number of exacerbations, but there was a tiny reduction in the number of exacerbations that required hospitalizations. So in summary, this is really just a bad drug that really offers very minimal benefit and probably should not be used except in very unusual circumstances.
Tell us what you really think, Henry.
Yeah, I mean, so there may be, what was the, do you happen to know offhand what the dose was? You know, this was not following levels in this study.
That's right. This was low dose, I think 200 to 300 milligrams once or twice a day in that range, just really tiny doses.
Yeah, before we started, these guys were teasing me because I'm the youngster in the group. I think I'm about 5 years younger than you guys, maybe seven. And that, Mark, do you know what theophylline is? Yes, I have actually done levels and tweaked levels and hated it, especially in childhood asthmatics was mostly where I was using it. So, and Henry, I'm curious about this. How do you know what the bottom of a birdcage tastes like? I don't know. It just seems like an odd thing to be sampling. I don't know. Anyway.
He just has a great imagination and is very colorful in the words that he chooses.
That's right. Well, guys, thank you very much for joining me today and talking over the poems. It's been a lot of fun having the conversation. Please tell your friends about the podcast. Spread the word. We do this every 2 weeks. We'll do it more often if we get more listeners, and really enjoying it so far. I hope you all enjoyed today's discussion. We did. And we'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.